Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight with Andrew Robert. It's turning off my phone. Does the same. Is the microphone working okay? Robert, you're the man in charge.
Okay.
Andrew Robert returns to the Sydney Institute. He's been here a couple of times before. He's spoken for us on the Liberal Party after the 1996 election, and he spoke for us on multiculturalism about a year ago. But I'll introduce him very briefly. Of course, his background is with the National Farmers Federation, with the Liberal Party, including a period as Liberal Party Federal Director. 8 years in the commercial world, doing a number of deals around the world, but particularly in Asia. And then Andrew Rock became the Liberal MP for Goldstein in 2004. He worked on the Work Choices Committee. He then became a Parliamentary Secretary for Multicultural Affairs, and in the final year of the Howard government, the Minister for Vocation and Further Training. Now, we did put down tonight's talk as Australia-India Strategic Imperatives, but we have a slight update, hot off the press. The slight update is uranium sales to India are strategic imperatives. So, Andrew Rock, welcome.
Well, thanks very much, Aaron, and to you too, Anne. To ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Some colleagues here tonight too. Nice to see those in the room. As Jared said, I've been here several times before. In fact, we're having a bit of a dispute before we started whether, in fact, I spoke last year or the year before. My recollection is, apart from the 96, is that over the last period since I entered Parliament with my ministerial responsibilities as multicultural affairs, I did my first major speech at the Institute, and as I understand it, last year, it was vacation and further education. My first speech of any consequence was here, and again tonight I'm very grateful for the opportunity at somewhat short notice that Jared and Anne put this opportunity together for me to make perhaps my first reasonably significant contribution in my new portfolio responsibility of foreign affairs. So I don't know what it says about the Institute and Jared and Anne, but I think it's something to do with bravery and certainly with persistence, so thank you for that. Often there's a reasonable measure of bipartisanship in a lot of the issues to do with foreign affairs. It's the nature of the beast, there's a lot of national interest associated with it, and there is often a lot of bipartisanship. So I chose the topic tonight because I thought it had emerged very quickly after the change of government as an issue of quite major difference between the two parties. And it is an issue, I think, which is of great consequence that we get this right. It's of great consequence to Australia and our future. And I do apologise for the slight change of title, but I was looking to talk more broadly about the strategic relationship with India. But the more work I have done over the last few weeks on this topic, the more I came to the view that if we don't get the issue of the sale of uranium right, it is the linchpin, it is the moment, it is the strategic guide for so many in India about our level of intent and the nature of the strategic relationship that we can forge going forward. So I've ended up focusing entirely really on that topic. Ladies and gentlemen, in August last year, the Howard government agreed to export uranium to India. The uranium was intended only for power generation and would not contribute to nuclear proliferation. The decision has since been overturned by the Rudd government, in fact, in the first few weeks of office. I contend that the Rudd government position is wrong and it is unsustainable. The decision also reflects confused and inconsistent policy priorities, given that one of the supposed three pillars of his foreign policy is enhanced, Mr. Rudd's foreign policy is enhancing relations with Asia. Ultimately, I expect that the Rudd government will need to reverse this decision not to sell Australian yellow cake to India. The decision, and in many respects the amateur way in which the decision was communicated to the Indian government, has left a very bitter taste in many Indian mouths. From a climate perspective, there is overwhelming merit in addressing the reality of India's energy needs, given the very stringent conditions India is prepared to accept to enter the international nuclear market for peaceful energy purposes. The Rudd government's position will also set back the cause of nuclear non-proliferation, ironically. The nuclear protocols agreed to last August would see 65% of all nuclear reactors in India coming under the strict coverage of the International Atomic Energy Agency, compared with now, where there's none. Global non-proliferation will be greatly strengthened by including India, a country which has an exemplary record on non-proliferation. Furthermore, the Rudd government's position is unsustainable from the point of view of wider bilateral interests, notably the potential free trade agreement between our two countries. The economic and the social and the security implications of such an agreement are potentially of enormous benefit to our community. There's been a lot of work in Thailand over the last few years before I came into the parliament, and I was involved in a lot of commercial deals. I was, in a pro bono sense, involved with the free trade agreement. I saw on the ground with the government, with business, in so many ways after that deal was completed, intangible benefits right across the economy and right across the relationship between Australia and Thailand. And I've got no doubt that if we can succeed in pulling off a free trade agreement with India, it'll have similar enormous benefits for Australia and for India, for that matter. But these implications of such an agreement are, I think, severely compromised and undermined by the decision to reverse uranium sales from India. Let me go back a bit, put a bit of context, historical perspective. From independence through until the end of the 20th century, Australia-India relations could best be described as qualified indifference. The foreign policy position of non-alignment, pioneered by Prime Minister Nehru, saw us as countries on opposite sides of many international issues through the Cold War period, from the Korean War to India's support for China and the UN to the Vietnam War and to the Soviet presence in Afghanistan. All of this, when combined with also the state of the Indian economy at the time, a 1980s and 1990s Australian view of India through the very narrow prism of the India-Pakistan conflict and the nuclear tests in 1998, all of that combined meant that relations between our two countries came to be characterised more by mutual disinterest or mutual testiness often. Our shared commitment to cricket and democracy probably helped us weather significant differences which sprung from other commitments and other alignments over these decades. Though some say cricket's the only thing that we have war with India at the moment. As well, I think the bond of the Commonwealth, which is often underestimated but shouldn't be in this case, in the role it played in carrying us through various differences. However, in this century, so much has changed. In a few short years, our relations have not only been normalised, but reached the point of a potentially strong and enduring strategic partnership. And just as the powerful strategic partnership India is forging with the United States has at its cornerstone the agreement for civilian nuclear cooperation, so too is this nuclear cooperation, I think, the primary factor in India's prospective full engagement with Australia. For Mr. Rudd not to see this is a serious error of judgment. This is particularly so at a time when Mr. Rudd is seeking a rotating seat on the UN Security Council, while denying India reliable clean energy, one of the very things that would bolster India's legitimate claim to be a permanent member of the UN Security Council. Australia must engage India because India has truly begun to look east with constructive and with responsible eyes. India is increasingly playing a vital role in the evolution of our region. It is the emerging powerhouse in South Asia. It is expected that India will pass China's population as the world's largest within 20 years at around 1.5 million people. The economic revolution, masterminded by India's current Prime Minister Singh when he was Finance Minister, heralds an economic awakening comparable to that prompted by Deng Xiaoping in China. Along with China, the rise of India in the years ahead look to be the major foe forces altering the world economy and world politics. The time for Australia to make a major political investment in India is now. The strategic imperative is overwhelming. In recent years, important groundwork has been laid, beginning with the significant counter-terrorism cooperation with India following 9/11, I think a significant turning point in many respects. The joint action over the tsunami. The decision by the Howard government to allow the export of Australian uranium for civil nuclear energy. The active support for India's bid to become a permanent member of the UN Security Council. The beginnings of negotiations for a bilateral free trade agreement. The involvement of Australia in quadrilateral talks involving the US, Japan and India. The joint naval exercise held in the Bay of Bengal in 2007. And of course, more than anything else perhaps, the extraordinary growth in our trade over the last 7 or 8 years. Already India is our fourth largest export market, with exports growing at year-on-year rates in excess of 30% since 2000, faster than export growth to China. Mining and agriculture are obvious growth centres, but investment and services also hold huge potential for growth. With India already our second largest source of overseas students, and tourism is expanding dramatically. All of this on top of the 250,000 strong Australian Indian community that does contribute so vibrantly, and I know this through my experience in multicultural affairs, it does contribute so vibrantly to the multicultural success of our nation, no less than our successful Chinese community. In terms of strategic initiatives of enormous moment to Australia since World War II, we should aim to be in a position in future years and look back and see comprehensive engagement with India in the 21st century standing alongside our achievement of other great partnerships, the signing of ANZUS in 1951, the formalising of our involvement with Japan in the 1950s, and our engagement with China in the 1990s and into this century. Now, in terms of energy needs, rapid population and economic growth will see a rapid rise in India's energy needs as it seeks to grow at close to 10% to lift its people out of poverty. As India grows, it will rank third behind the US and China in terms of global energy use. Power generation will account for much of the increase in primary energy demand, given surging electricity demand in industry and in residential and in commercial buildings. Most of the new electricity generating capacity will be fueled by coal. Among end users, transport is, of course, the fastest growing one. You've seen the $3,000 car, which, again, I think, given the cost of motorbikes, will transform. Transport in India and many other parts of Asia. In the absence of strong alternative policy action, galloping energy demand will see major increases in imports of coal, oil and gas, and in the generation of greenhouse gas emissions. Over the next 25 years, for logistical and quality reasons, their coal is very poor quality. Much of India's coal will need to be met by imports. The trend is evidenced by the growth in Australia's exports to India since 2000. Until 1990, we exported no coal to India. In 2000-2001, Australia exported just over $800 million worth of coal to India in that year. Last year, our coal reached 2.5 billion, an extraordinary 300% growth in 6 years. Again, over the next 25-year period, primary energy demand in India is expected to double, with India overtaking Japan before 2025 to become the world's third largest net importer of oil after the United States and China. All of this adds up to India becoming the world's third largest emitter of carbon dioxide by 2015. Two-thirds of India's emissions come from burning coal, mainly in power stations. India will not sacrifice development to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. They will only occur by employing less carbon-intensive energy, nuclear, gas or clean coal. This has been strongly emphasised by Prime Minister Singh, who has said, and I quote, "Nuclear energy offers a way out by providing clean energy for development. So I see enormous opportunities for members of the Nuclear Suppliers Group and India with regard to supply of raw materials, technology and reactors," end quote. The greenhouse impact of nuclear power generation is brought home by the fact that the export of Australian uranium ore concentrates in 2006-07 was sufficient to power 50 reactors, producing about 40% more than Australia's total electricity production. Countries using our uranium avoid carbon dioxide emissions roughly equivalent to our entire annual CO2 emissions from all sources. If the uranium deal succeeds, by 2050, as much as 35% of India's total energy needs could be met by clean nuclear power plants. So how do we ensure the non-weapon use of our uranium? Australian uranium export policy has consistently recognised that special arrangements need to be put in place to distinguish between the civil and the military applications of nuclear energy. When adopted in 1977, Australia's export policy was a more rigorous safeguards policy than any other country supplying uranium to world markets. Australia's policy embodies fundamental tenets first outlined in 1977 and adjusted to reflect a number of developments in the intervening period. For example, the sale of uranium to a non-signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is not unprecedented. In 1981, the Fraser government negotiated an agreement to sell uranium to France, with Australia exporting uranium to them throughout the 80s under the Hawke government. However, France did not become a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty until 1992. Australia has always required assurances that exported uranium and its derivatives cannot assist the development of nuclear weapons or be used in other military programs. It is only sold for exclusively peaceful purposes, power generation and related research and development. Now, this is done by precisely accounting for amounts of Australia-obligated nuclear material as it moves through the full nuclear fuel cycle. It is exported under Australia's network of bilateral safeguards agreements, which ensures coverage by the International Atomic Energy Agency. From the time it leaves Australian ownership for the full life of it. Now, the US-India nuclear deal, struck personally between Prime Minister Singh and President Bush, was concluded in principle last August after 2 years of negotiation. The deal separates India's nuclear energy program from its nuclear weapons program. To be finalised, the agreement must pass the US Congress, get the International Atomic Energy Agency to meet a special protocol to oversight India's peaceful nuclear power plants and receive agreement by the 45-member Nuclear Suppliers Group to sell uranium to India. Very importantly, the US-India deal will strengthen nuclear non-proliferation by making very significant progress in drawing India in under the safeguard and oversight of the International Atomic Energy Agency. In due course, a really important point is given, trying to set the scene for why our opponents have got an opposite point of view, and their only argument, really, is about nuclear non-proliferation. And I would contend very strongly, and I'm not alone, as most people contend, most of those, the Americans in particular, who put this deal together, and the many other countries that have already given tacit agreement to signing up to the Nuclear Suppliers Group approval. In due course, many of them see that this program in India may prompt progress with other non-signatories of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It will be a leading edge development, perhaps, with other countries of much greater concern. The agreement will put 65% of India's nuclear program, or 14 of its 22 nuclear reactors, under the stringent safeguards of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The agreement would be a break with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which disallows sales of uranium to countries with nuclear weapons, except the nuclear weapon nations of the United States, Britain, France, Russia and China. As India has nuclear weapons, it therefore, by definition, cannot join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, despite never proliferating nuclear technology to any nation. Against this background, the US-India agreement accepts the reality of India as a weapons state, but allows India's peaceful nuclear energy program to gain access to uranium, nuclear technology and nuclear reactors. It is a common sense accommodation of India's circumstances and its standing and its role in the world, just as sensible accommodations have been made for China in various regional and global matters. The Howard government agreed last August, against that background, to sell uranium to India, subject to the finalisation of the US-India deal and the conclusion of a bilateral Australia-India safeguards agreement. From a strategic point of view, it is really critical to Australia that arrangement, I think, is reversed and goes through. Subsequent rejection by the Labor Party is reversed and it goes through. It was proposed that Australia sell uranium to India according to the identical strict safeguards under which we sell uranium to China and Russia. In years gone by, China has sold nuclear technology to Pakistan and North Korea, unlike India, which has abided by the NPT obligations, even from the outside. In these circumstances, and provided the conditions agreed with India are fully met, it would be highly hypocritical to deny India this technology while China benefits from full nuclear access. Furthermore, if the US-India agreement is finalised, including approval by the International Atomic Energy Agency, then any Australian government opposition would be a very serious matter and invite long-term misunderstanding in our relationship with India. It's already inviting significant misunderstanding in our relationship with India. It is already of great consequence. India and Australia are two great democracies, sharing the common values and interests of democracy. We are partners in regionalism as members of the Commonwealth members of the East Asia Summit. This is a critical moment, I put to you, in seeking to cement an Australian-Indian strategic partnership, a relationship of great importance to Australia's interests and Australia's future. It is a strategic partnership that can be built around the challenge of energy in an energy-hungry world, while simultaneously addressing two of the great challenges of our time, climate change and non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. On greenhouse considerations alone, this agreement is a must-do. Opposing it forces India into increasing reliance on its substantial dirty coal reserves. However, other considerations are also very compelling. There is strategic sense in seeing the largest democracy in the region taking a stronger role in the region, and in a way where it enjoys the respect and the standing of other major regional powers. There is India's position to be protected and nurtured as our fourth biggest export market, in a burgeoning trade relationship. There is a growing bilateral security relationship to be fostered, especially involving cooperation in counter-terrorism and in maintaining stability in the Indian Ocean. And critically, there is an opportunity to significantly advance the cause of non-proliferation by bringing 65% of all India's nuclear reactors under UN inspections and under the protocols of the International Atomic Energy Agency. At the same time, it creates a safer and more secure environment for these nuclear power stations. Given all these considerations, it is remarkable that one of Labor's first acts as a government was to summon the Indian nuclear envoy and advise him that for party political reasons, and it was the only reason, Australia would not be selling uranium to India. The manner, the timing, and the substance of this communication was highly condescending. It was inept and it was wrong. The national interest was not considered. Climate change was ignored. Nuclear non-proliferation was sidelined. A China bias was implied. Constructive US policy towards Asia was opposed. And India's feelings were trampled on. And all in the interest of an irrational and weak sop to the hard left of the Labor Party. Mr Rudd is putting the internal machinations of the Labor Party ahead of the national interest. Again, it goes to poor judgment. If Labor is committed to all it has said about global warming, then refusing to sell uranium to India while supporting new uranium sales to China and Russia is totally hypocritical and irrational. How can the Rudd government claim moral leadership on the global stage in reducing greenhouse gas emissions when it ducks the first hard decision which would result in massive reductions in emissions? Furthermore, the decision comes at a time when the sale of our coal to India has grown 300% in 6 years, with the growth in sales showing no sign of slowing. So much for consistency. This old thinking of Australia's Labor government is starkly revealed when compared against the agreement last week of Britain and France to construct a new generation of nuclear power stations and export the technology around the world in an effort to combat climate change. To add to the confusion, the Rudd government is saying to our Indian friends that we don't trust them with our uranium, while at the same time Mr Rudd has said he's not yet made up his mind on whether to veto sales by the 44 other members of the nuclear suppliers group. This makes no sense. How can Australia refuse to sell our uranium to India, yet plausibly support the rest of the world supplying uranium? Either way, Australia will be adding insult to injury. How can the Rudd government claim that Australia's relationship with India is a high priority when it snubs this direct and heartfelt request from the highly respected Prime Minister of the world's largest democracy? It is stupidity, in my view. India is understood to be deeply offended by the Rudd government decisions and the manner in which it was conveyed. And all of my intelligence and contacts and relationships confirms that judgment. Influential foreign affairs commentators from India have denounced the decision in the strongest terms, labelling the scrapping of the pledge to sell uranium as, and I quote, retrograde ideology, pathetic hypocrisy, misplaced non-proliferation zealotry, and accusing our Prime Minister of parroting, and I quote, the same lame excuse as if he has not read the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty text, unquote. The observation has been pointedly made that far from the NPT forbidding civil exports to a non-signatory, the treaty indeed encourages the peaceful use of nuclear technology among all states. Further comments claim that Prime Minister Rudd has no qualms about selling uranium to China, but will not export it to India. As well, the simultaneous holding of a strong position on greenhouse gases and a disposition against selling uranium to an energy-starved India is seen in India as showing, again, in quotes, a lack of logic. The bottom line on all of this is that reversing Australia's commitment to sell uranium to India will do substantial damage to the Australia-India relationship. It makes absolutely no sense to sell uranium to China and Russia and not to India. it makes absolutely no sense to claim climate change to be the great moral challenge of our time, and then block the adoption of nuclear technology, which is greenhouse gas free, and which already provides 16% of the world's electricity needs. The US-India nuclear agreement is good for India, it's good for Australia, it's good for the region, it's good for climate change, and it's good for nuclear non-proliferation. In this regard, Labor is standing against a critical new engagement in Asia. This issue can make Australia a strategically important partner to India. It is the thing really what India really wants from us. It's a big issue. Ladies and gentlemen, Labor's position is bad policy and it's disastrous politics. It is a position that is unsustainable. It can and it must be reversed. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Mr. Rudd. There's a seat up in front here that I want. So we come to question. Sorry,
Mr. Rudd, not Mr.
Thanks, Mr. Rob. I'm going to ask you about Mr. Rudd. Kevin Rudd gave his last speech as a shadow foreign minister on foreign policy to the Sydney Institute in late 2006, and he spoke then about the priority that he gave to the United Nations, and since becoming Prime Minister, he's also spoken a lot about the priority he gives to the United Nations, including his recent address here in Sydney. You're saying that this policy of Labor's will be overturned, but in view of Kevin Rudd's commitment to the United Nations and the support for the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, I mean, do you really think he's going to back off on this?
Well, the Atomic Energy Agency is a UN authority, and they have already implied support for the US. India nuclear civil energy deal. There is every expectation that it goes through the Congress and it is satisfactorily agreed to within India. And of course, there are issues there because of India's long-standing relationship or lack thereof with the United States. But there is, I think, broad acceptance that if all those stars line up, that the UN agency will in fact fully endorse it. And this is the point, in a sense. We have 40% of the world's uranium. So what we do as a supplier, there's 44 other countries, but we have 40% of the uranium. So what we do as a supplier will have a significant influence over the attitudes of many of the others in the end. So I think it's, it runs in the face of where the UN is heading. And it is solely domestic political politics. I can take you to 2/3 of the Labor Party members, and they would all agree with what I've just said. They would all agree with that. And yet, for crass political purposes, we've got a relationship of enormous moment to Australia. The consequences of this are huge. And yet we are putting it in jeopardy because of crass political politics. Labor Party internal politics, and it needs to be exposed and it needs to be reversed. I think, and I don't know, they're the government, but I think ultimately the importance of this decision and all that goes with it will make it impossible for this government not to reverse the decision. Just saying on the road now, when I stood for election in 2004, put my posters up, and a lot of the Liberal supporters in Goldstein, where I'm a member, were coming to the office saying, you've got to tear down the posters because many of our people won't vote for you because you look like Kevin Rudd.
Are you going to tell us that up in Brisbane? I'll put them all up because
I wasn't as well known as Kevin until I
did. Mr. Rob, I think the selling uranium to China must be much more dangerous to sell uranium to India. My question is, do you think what is the possibility for the opposition to mount the pressure onto the government to make another reverse back to the deal of selling uranium to India, the deal which was made by a former Howard government.
Thank you. Yes. I know when we were in government that we were satisfied that the bilateral agreement that we'd struck with China, and in turn the commitments entered into by China, meant that all the uranium coming from Australia is monitored all the way through the energy cycle and that it is solely used for civilian purposes. My point about China was that they have done sometime in the past, but they have done. They are a signatory, and yet they have provided technology to Pakistan and North Korea that's known. It's a little bit ironic that India, that has been exemplary in terms of its non-proliferation and the use of technology and all the rest, should not enjoy at least equal status with China in the access to uranium for civil nuclear purposes. I don't think it'll be reversed, that's my answer. I think we're satisfied with what's going on with China, but we want to maintain my point of view, the opposition, and certainly the our government's view, was that for consistency, India should be afforded the same opportunity.
Thanks for such a very nice and brilliant presentation. It was very interesting and enlightening. I have one question. When your government was in power, this policy of supplying uranium to India was piggybacked on the US clearance. If you came back to power, could you still piggyback it to the US clearance?
Yes, because the US, it wasn't US clearance, it was that the US and India could find an agreement which gave recognition, I think really by one superpower to an emerging superpower, of their standing in the world, the reality of their nuclear situation, the reality of their emerging role in Asia, and their leadership role that's expected of them. I think it meant that if the US and India could find an agreement which met both their objectives, and also given India's history vis-à-vis the United States in the 20th century and the lack of relationship for all the well-known reasons and the striking independence of India, especially when it comes to issues in relationship to the United States. All of those things, I think, are important indicators that this is an arrangement which is robust.
Oh,
and so something that the Atomic Nuclear Energy Agency was prepared to see as an appropriate indicator of a satisfactory arrangement. So on all those counts, I think if we were back in office, we would stay with what we had decided last year, and that is if all of those conditions can be met, then it's a sensible thing for us to sell uranium to India.
Next question here.
Yeah. Andrew, in all of this, why is it that India won't sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and is there any chance they'll change their minds about that?
The question is why India won't sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Andrew,
could you just talk to the back of the room?
Yeah, sorry. The thing is that India can't sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement unless it disposes of all its nuclear weapons. That the agreement prescribed five nations that could have nuclear weapons and continue to purchase uranium from other countries. This US-India deal, in a sense, recognises the reality that India is not going to dispose of its nuclear weapons, yet has a standing, a reputation, a history already in regards to not propagating, proliferating nuclear technology and all the rest, that it is comparable to the other five that are in the treaty who can acquire uranium. So at the moment, India can't sign up.
No.
If it wanted to, can't sign up unless it gets rid of the nuclear weapons, and it won't get rid of the nuclear weapons. Now, that's the judgment. That's why the United States, which really fell out in 74 in a very big way with India over these nuclear tests, fell out again in a much bigger way in 1998 over the nuclear tests. The fact, to answer the earlier gentleman's question, that is, if the United States can be satisfied on all the various counts that India is an appropriate and responsible and equivalent member of that group of five, then it makes sense to reach an accommodation. Because for all the other benefits that go with it, the greenhouse gas issues and all the rest of it.
John?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Rock. You did mention that a lot of stars had to be aligned to make this work. Could you discuss, please, the role of the minor parties within India, who were not prepared to accept the degree of supervision that you're alluding to? In fact, they want independence from any degree, any supervision.
That's true. And it's still not an issue which is fully resolved. And I suppose this has been, from the outset, a matter of political judgment by Prime Minister Singh and everyone else involved. That ultimately the politics, and it is again, a lot of it's the politics of trying to secure votes in India, where a lot of the minor parties who have played the US card and continue to play the US card in relationship to elections, for all the reasons I spoke about earlier throughout the 20th century, it's a potent card to play in the elections. They are, deeply proud people and proud of their independence. So that is still to be played out. But I've now spoken with many people who are far better associated than I am with the politics of India. Again, the feeling is that such is the benefits that will flow, especially from the US. India strategic partnership that is emerging as a result of this. The economic growth. India desperately needs the sort of the soft power of the US, technology in particular, and foreign investment. And this deal and the relationship that flows from that will bring enormous foreign investment from the US and other places, and great access to the advanced technology, not just nuclear technology across the board, because India has got such a desperate need for it. It also will bring clean energy to India, which again is an extraordinarily powerful argument locally. And also I've worked in a lot of countries, in Thailand and other parts of Asia. The whole environmental issue is becoming enormously powerful. In my view, in some of those Asian countries, the power of environmental issues is such that it may well equate with the power of the sort of anti-American sentiment that's being peddled. The third thing is the whole national security argument, that the deal does provide tacit acceptance of India's right to nuclear deterrence, and that is equated with independence. So again, when the arguments are laid out, if the deal is done, and the arguments are then laid out, there is an expectation this will be quite compelling for a lot of the Indian community. And finally, and very importantly, it will be seen as enhancing India's international status. And, you know, there's great pride in their membership of the G8 and the East Asia Summit, as there should be. And there is an expectation that they should have a permanent seat at the UN Security Council, and more. Right. So the capacity for this deal to be a forerunner for India assuming over time its proper role in the scheme of things provides a series of arguments which, I'm told, Prime Minister Singh and others, Singh ultimately will prevail in the local Indian community. So if, I suppose it brings an even sharper focus the role of Australia in all of this. If we stand there and say to the Indian community, we don't trust you with our uranium, that's sort of, you know, condescending sort of view that has got up their nose for so long. It will, by itself, be a major piece of ammunition for the minor parties that you talk about in standing against this agreement.
Question here. Let me go down there. Yeah.
If you exempt India from the NPT, aren't you opening the can of worms just a little bit? And there's Pakistan and Israel and Japan and Iran and, you know, isn't this going to open some bigger problems along the way a little?
Well, as I put it, it has and it would involve 65% of all of India's nuclear reactors being brought under the control and supervision. Now that means that there is the Atomic Energy Agency in India supervising, becoming aware of the use of uranium for all purposes. Not fully aware, but okay, it is a major departure from the current situation in terms of the knowledge of the rest of the world of the use and the nature of use of uranium within India and nuclear power. So it also needs to be recognised that the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty has been modified in the past. We sold uranium to France for 10 years under both sides' apologies long before that signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The actions of China in selling nuclear technology to North Korea and Pakistan and suspicions of other places, all of that has been accommodated and protocols put in place. So, rather than opening the door, I think it opens the door to potential supervision of other countries if they met certain circumstances. Now, the thing is, what India has signed up to with the Americans is as strict as any other user within the non-proliferation, any other of the major, the five. It's identical to Russia, it's identical to China. And, as I say, I think quite the contrary, it opens the door to an opportunity down the track to embrace some of the more recalcitrant countries that have in fact nuclear weapons.
Protocol, the next one, as you will recall, Peter Walshman was the finance minister of the Hawke government. I used the delight of annoying the left by reminding them that when Jim Cairns was in the Whitlam government, he tried to sell uranium to the Shah of Iran. The problem with that comment was it was true. You shouldn't make it well received. Down the back there.
My question follows on more from the question before we asked in response to that. Was it about a year ago that Dr. Machari, the chairman of the IPCC, was a vice governor at the University of New South Wales? And in living a vote of thanks to Dr. Machari, a senior member of the Australia or India Business Council, made the comment that Australia needs India more than India needs Australia. Now, at the time, I wasn't quite sure what that comment had to do with the content of Dr. Machari's address, but I did find it thought-provoking. I was wondering if you could describe what, if any, meaning you attach to the comment that Australia needs India more than India needs Australia. First of all, from
Well, there's many elements of a strategic partnership which has started to emerge in a very powerful way just in the last 6 or 7 years between ourselves and India. And we are, without a doubt, the principal beneficiary. Almost all of the things that they're sourcing from us could be sourced elsewhere. I mean, maybe at a higher price and all sorts of other things, but they could be sourced elsewhere. And we haven't even scratched the surface in terms of the opportunity that exists there. We have got 250,000 Australian Indians in our community. You know, they are the second biggest source of students now. We are building and have built for many years, but we're building now links back into India which are enormously valuable if we can leverage those links. But it requires a sense of partnership between the two countries. The whole issue of security in the Indian Ocean, you know, we have started to do some joint naval activities, and we've got all of the very powerful work that's been done in regards to counter-terrorism. And I think the tsunami experience, going back to Kevin Rudd of the UN, I mean, one of the things that brought all of this together with the US and India and ourselves in Japan was that whilst the UN was dragging its feet out of the tsunami, the four countries got in and did the job, and did an enormous job in order to quickly and effectively deal with the aftermath of the tsunami. So there's all sorts of social and economic and political advantages, but it will be seen, and it is already being seen, as potentially a very serious snub. And as I say, you can't discount the sense in large parts of India of the condescension that prevailed for so long, and with all the colonial issues and all the rest of it. But then with the US and their support for Pakistan, and their strong military support for Pakistan, it all got turned on the Indians. So yeah, listen, there are issues here of great moment throughout a whole century, really, which means that the sense of independence and the pride is palpable, as I see it, in India. And if we do things as a small nation to, you know, if we trail our coat in a way which offends all of those sensibilities, they will say, you don't need you. We've got plenty of other relationships to build, and we'll get all of that opportunity that's just sitting there for the taking. There's so much that we've now got in common, so many links we've already got, the leverage that other countries haven't got. It will just be a bigger shame if we do not capitalise on that and do the same thing.
Okay, so we're running towards the end. So we go there, Owen Harries, and finish with Dennis Grant.
Yes, Mr. Rudd, you mentioned that four-way agreement, US, Japan, Australia, India. Am I right in understanding that that's another matter that the broke up with the region?
Yes.
And that would have similar.
Well, again, this is a quadrilateral agreement. It was an agreement of a dialogue of quadrilateral nature over the last, I think it was formed, the Japanese Prime Minister Abe, when he was in power, was particularly enthusiastic about this. He met with John Howard and met with the Prime Minister Singh and President Bush, and they all came on board. It was a very strong Japanese initiative, but well supported by the others. But it was not intended to be a security agreement. Now, I think Prime Minister Abe might have had that in mind, but the other parties, as I understand, and there was a meeting of officials. It was intended to be a very senior official level. And there was a first meeting, I think, last July or August. And you're right. When Labor came into office, they said, and it's been interpreted as, again, a China bias, that they would not proceed. But, and actually, the denunciation of it was, I think, more the problem. It's much less an issue than what I've been talking about tonight. There's no comparison. But I think there's a view that the strong bilateral relationships of all those countries is sort of more important. But the decision
to renounce that dialogue was made at a press conference by Stephen Smith with the Chinese foreign minister. Now, for the Japanese, Stephen Smith had just been to Japan. I know for a fact that he did not raise it in formal discussions. He has said subsequently back here that he did raise it in Japan, but it was in an interview with Alan Jones back into Australia. It happened to be a hotel room in Japan. He did raise it in Japan, but with Alan Jones. But he made the formal announcement at a press conference with the Chinese foreign minister. The Indian officials and whatever, and the Japanese in particular, again created a lot of misunderstanding and confusion about what is going on in terms of the various relationships.
Owen Harries?
You made some very powerful points against Rudd's policy, particularly, I think, in respect to the global warming issue, use of coal, and also with respect to the double standards applied to China and Russia, as opposed to India. Where I found you rather less convincing was on the question of emphasizing the strict monitoring of Australian uranium when it reached India. Isn't uranium a fungible material? Doesn't that mean that if Australia supplies uranium to China, to India, and if that can't be used for nuclear weapons purposes, all it means is that it's freeing India's other uranium for such uses?
Yes, but India has not got as I understand it, the access to uranium, which will provide them with the opportunity to meet 5% of their civil nuclear power requirements, much less 35% by the middle of the century. And so, in the absence of an agreement of this nature, there's absolutely no capacity. They have got a capacity to maintain their nuclear weapons, so that's a given. That's not going to change. What will be compromised if this deal is not finalised and satisfied is that the capacity, as you quite rightly said, for greenhouse gas emissions to be reduced will be very severely hindered. And there is no alternative. There's no alternative source of baseload power that's going to provide, you know, any more than 5 or 10% of India's nuclear energy, of India's energy requirements in the years ahead. So I know the point you're making, but the fact of the matter is, as I understand it, they just simply haven't got access to sufficient quantities. And they've got sufficient quantities for nuclear weapon, and that they will maintain that for security reasons. Right? So that is a given. That won't change, as I understand. You know, the fact that India has nuclear weapons power is a fact of life now and can be maintained into the future. They've got sufficient supplies for that. They have not got supplies to go beyond their current civil nuclear requirements.
Final question, Robert Grundy.
It was announced today that the senior American environmental scientist, not connected with the administration, but I think with NASA, has called on Kevin Rudd to peg Australia's coal developments and coal exports at the current level. On one hand, there's an energy demanding world, and Australia is rich in those resources. How do you see the Rudd government, not the Robb government, negotiating its way through that particular dilemma?
The coal dilemma?
The dilemma of being rich in resources and having coal which threatens carbon emissions and carbon levels of the world and having other resources and the world's demand.
Yes. I think the only solution is technology, innovation. You know, we have got, I'm from Victoria. We've still got 300 or 400 or 500 years of brown brown coal in Victoria. The reason Victoria was an industrial powerhouse in Australia for so long, it was built on cheap energy, cheap electricity. And we still, you know, we still have got hundreds and hundreds of years of coal, even if we sell so much of it elsewhere. But I think increasingly, as evidenced by the announcement today, you know, the pressure's coming on and on. Even ourselves, we are implementing an emissions trading scheme, which is basically a tax on coal and other fossil fuels. Right, so that's another form of the cap that the American announced or suggested today. So the only solution to me is, it's so important to our future, the resource that we've got, that we have got an enormous obligation to spend very huge amounts of money. I've got great confidence in the capacity of the scientific community to find solutions which will dramatically reduce the greenhouse emissions that come from coal. I had 2 years' work with the Gorgon project off the northwest shelf on Barrow Island, where they're going down several kilometres to bury CO2. I mean, that's the money and the technology and the development there is just breathtaking. And the solution, the problems they've solved, it's 3 years since I was working with them, the problems they've solved even in those 3 years in terms of carbon capture are just remarkable, right? And there is enormous opportunity around Australia, enormous opportunity to bury CO2. And that's just one of the technologies. So, you know, I look at India, in fact, it's remarkable. India is now ranked as the third highest in terms of scientific expertise in the world and higher education, third. And yet 65%, it's only got 65% literacy rates. Mm-hmm. India has not spent money on primary and secondary education. But years ago they took a decision to pour unbelievable amounts of money into universities. And as a consequence, you know, they're two-thirds of Silicon Valley, all the rest of the stories you know better than I do. I mean, what it shows to me is you put the money in, you put the focus, you deliver an outcome. And that, to me, is our answer. But it means spending, I think, many multiples of what we're currently spending on technology in that area.
And Rob, many thanks. I know there were more questions, but it's 7 o'clock and 1 minute later, so we're over. I'll be very brief. Sometimes you hear criticism of oppositions that they can't get their message across, but I think it's true to say that Andrew Robb's comments tonight are completely unambiguous, and that anyone will walk out the door not comprehending what he said, irrespective of whether they agree with him or not. So I'd just like to congratulate our speaker on a very clear presentation tonight. I'm sure your speech will raise a lot of interest. It'll be good to publish it in time in the Sydney papers. It goes up on our podcast tomorrow. But for now, many thanks for an important address. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.